The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network is proud to present The Orthodox Medievalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of history, a professional writer, and a priest of the Russian Orthodox Church. His web journal can be found at russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everyone, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Medievalist. I want to thank all of my listeners and all my friends for their support over the last few months, and of course the Voice of Reason Network that has made this all possible. We've been talking about the Middle Ages for some time now, and because everything really is connected in our history, we're going to shift gears again and talk about the contemporary situation in Ukraine, which is frightening, to say the very least, in terms of the suffering of the people, the complete destruction of their lifestyle, and really the taking, you know, the great tragedy of Soviet communism, and very similarly in democratic capitalism in the West, is that the labor of the working classes, the lower middle classes, is appropriated by those with power. That would include the state, that would include the major financial institutions, that would include the major manufacturing concerns, and it's really the great tragedy. In post-Soviet Russia, it's been increased substantially, where even the labor of the population that had been expropriated by the state, Ukraine, Belarus, Central Asia, Russia itself, has then further been expropriated by a small clique of oligarchs, almost exclusively Jewish, who have enriched themselves, sent much of their money abroad, and in fact, even more frightening, sent their money abroad into research institutes, all the major foundations in the West. And so some of the oligarchs' money is being used to finance some of the scholarly research that in many ways seeks to exonerate the oligarchs, even calling them tycoons and people who have succeeded in the free market. When you listen to conservatives, and I'm here to tell you that I may have been a conservative in college, but I certainly have not been a conservative for many years. When you listen to the conservatives talk, you realize you're dealing with some of the most stupid people, some of the most controlled and manipulated people in American politics. After the fall of communism in the early 90s, conservatives began talking about the free market, as if that was even a remote possibility in Russian society. The fact is that the collapse of the state, the collapse of what little control there was on economic activity, simply meant that those with power, whether it be the oligarchs who came from the black market or the other oligarchs who came from the bureaucracy, these people then were able to take advantage of the collapse of the state and arrange everything for their own benefit. But it wasn't merely the conservatives, the Heritage Foundation, idiots like Ariel Cohen. It was also people, the economics department at Harvard University, the U.S. government. So many major universities had gone over there, founding research institutes, all dedicated to this ridiculous free market idea, which, at least in the Russian context or the Ukrainian context, simply meant that those with power were able to place their power now on a new footing. where in Soviet times it was with the state or with the black market, which of course was very large, particularly under Gorbachev, and even at the end of the Brezhnev era, the black market was very large. Or the bureaucracy, you know, I mean, and any of these older sources of power, they simply were able to rig everything with the full support, including financial support of the U.S. government, Western Europeans, and reorganize their power on a new basis, and that is the control over money. And money was a means then to place their power somewhere else, and they founded political parties and political movements. And that really is the crime of the early and mid 90s. Now, people like Putin, people like Kuchma, these people did everything in their power to break at least the most obnoxious of the oligarchical factions. And in Belarus, Lukashenko was forced to stop all forms of privatization, even to the point where he had to throw the IMF out of the country, because they were promoting this kind of oligarchization of Slavic life. And Lukashenko, because he had explicitly adopted and made no bones about his social nationalist and non-aligned political views, he was able to maintain a certain degree of economic equality, a certain degree of worker pride in their jobs and in their positions, and as a result, substantially lowered unemployment and maintained an extremely robust economic growth. In fact, the fact is that Belarus is, according to the World Bank, who was an enemy of Belarus, the best off in terms of standard of living and basic quality of life issues of all the post-Soviet states. Now, the situation in Ukraine is, and I've written about this, you know, endlessly, starting in 2004, the American government, certain Western Ukrainian oligarchs and the world's banking institutions led by the Rothschilds began to finance a campaign to put these oligarchs back in power. To some extent, and I don't want to exaggerate this, but to some extent, Kuchma was attempting to imitate Leonid Kuchma, who had been the previous president just prior to Yushchenko, who's president now, tried to imitate, to some extent, Putin and Lukashenko by eliminating the influence of the worst oligarchs and attempting to put the rest on some kind of a legal footing. And I have an article out called Putin and Lukashenko by the Numbers, also concerns Ukraine, about how this was economically very successful. That this kind of statism and this attempt to purge the oligarchs, I mean, it was probably impossible that they all could be eliminated completely, but to purge them, the most obnoxious of them, rein in the rest as much as humanly possible. You know, this really became the focus of public policy in those three countries. At least in terms of economic growth and control over unemployment, it was successful. Remember something else, too. These three leaders, Putin, Kuchma, Lukashenko, these people were not in a position to destroy the oligarchy entirely, partially because certain factions of the oligarchy had most of their wealth overseas. If governments want that back in the country, they have to step very lightly. So you see that they're not in the most enviable position in the world. Now, as far as Ukraine is concerned, and that's what we're going to focus on today, what we're really dealing with is the complete miserable failure of the most blatant attempt of the American government and the Rothschilds and the exiled oligarchs very close to the Rothschilds. In fact, Gudzinski living in Great Britain is extremely close to the Rothschilds. Kutakovsky and his empire also extremely close to the Rothschilds, which in turn means that they are extremely close to the major think tanks and research foundations of America, some of which are funded substantially by the Rothschild fronts, and the Carnegie Institute is one of these. Needless to say, the Carnegie Institute has been the most vociferous in terms of attacking Putin and his friends in the Slavic world. But the complete failure of this coalition installing Viktor Yushchenko and a vile adventurer and oligarch, Yulia Tymoshenko, in Ukraine, it's really going to be the subject of the talk today. And it really shows the complete failure of the IMF. It shows the failure of the American model of economics as applied to Ukraine. That in 2004, there was a disputed election in Ukraine, as most of you remember. And George Soros had, through his Open Society Foundation, had organized a series of demonstrations, and these actually were organized before the fact. And furthermore, that these groups and people had financed the campaign of Yushchenko and had provided him with a lot of high-tech equipment, first-rate computer technicians, fax machines, and cell phones, and there's a tremendous financial political infrastructure. And in fact, this was comically proven just a couple of years ago when the oligarch in Great Britain, Vladimir Guzinski, had complained that people like George Soros and the Ukrainian government were not giving him enough credit for his manipulation of the Ukrainian elections in 2004, fully admitting that the elections were completely bogus, Yushchenko's victory was completely bogus, and essentially it was a coup d'etat to remove the statist and nationalist faction under Kuchma and to install the cosmopolitan duo of Yushchenko and Tymoshenko. They have since split, and under their control, Ukraine has fallen absolutely positively into the abyss of poverty and corruption that did not exist even in Soviet times. All but the most hardcore supporter of the so-called Orange Revolution will admit this, that as the Ukrainian economy has fallen into a tailspin, they have been bickering amongst themselves, and the fact is that the IMF, one of the big supporters of this movement, came out and said, and this is very recently, and it's been picked up by the opposition, the social nationalist opposition in Ukraine, that because of the immense bribery within the Orange government, the Ukrainian government cannot meet the requirements to cut public spending to the international, you know, in accordance with the wishes of the International Monetary Fund. That's corruption. The point where so much public money is being used to pay off friends of the Orange Revolution and give them jobs and give them positions and make sure that they're rewarded for their loyalty to the state, specifically to the Orange state, the fact is that public spending can't be cut because so much of that budget, both, you know, on-budget and off-budget items, and that's, by the way, a very, very big gray area in Ukrainian politics right now, so-called discretionary funds and all this nonsense, not to mention money and slush funds being provided by oligarchs throughout, not just in the Slavic world, but oligarchs throughout the world who see their friends in the Slavic world under attack. All of this money is not being used to support the population in a time of severe economic dislocation. And the fact of the matter is that at the moment you have about 60%, depends on the poll that you look at. There's several American polls. I think one was from Time magazine that said 57% of the Ukrainian population wants Yushchenko and the orange government to resign. Now, here are a few facts concerning the situation in Ukraine. I want to say something here, and it's been a problem. It's been a problem with me for a long time, and that is the nature of the state relative to all this. I mean, my ideal political vision is that, you know, it's the culture and the way of life and the religion of the common population. It's that basis on which political sovereignty and legitimacy lies. It's the ancient culture of the Slavic peoples in their different linguistic and regional and economic organizations and bases. The state has a tendency and has a history of living parasitically off of that inheritance and using it to justify their own policies. And in Ukraine was a particularly blatant case there, because so many of the Western and New York advisors that were coming into Kiev in 03 supporting the Yushchenko campaign were encouraging him to use lots of national symbols, old Cossack symbols, old peasant symbols, even old Orthodox symbols, that at least none of the political elite really believed in, but to use this as a way to live parasitically off the ancient tradition of Ukraine, a tradition that is immensely popular in Ukraine itself. But here you have these cosmopolitans, these people without national or regional identification whatsoever, using nationalist symbols to buttress their power, a power that has been used for absolutely nothing but evil. Nothing but lining their own pockets. And you know, this is the opinion of the Ukrainian population in general. I'm not giving you my opinion here. This is what the Ukrainian polls say. And now, in 2009, this is what the IMF is saying. Basically, the West is saying, you've betrayed us. You know, which of course is an act. They knew exactly what was going to happen when this bunch got installed in power. That's how oligarchs act in America, in Great Britain, in Africa, in East Asia. That's how oligarchs function. The world is their oyster. The states, the nation, the people, the land, these are just objects that they could use, for their own will. This is how oligarchy has always functioned, and this is why oligarchy is the greatest political evil conceivable. And yet, it is the dominant form of political organization throughout the world, with very few exceptions. So, the failure of the Orange Revolution is admitted by almost everybody. Fact is that right now, inflation is running in Ukraine about 30% a year, which means that you have a substantial economic contraction. So if, in general, you have 2% yearly GDP growth in Ukraine, with 3 and 4% inflation a month, you see that, of course, the economy is, in actual pocketbook terms, shrinking. The fact is that people's standard of living is falling. According to the World Bank, 40% of the Ukrainian population lives below the poverty line. 40% of the Ukrainian population. This was not the case under Kuchma. In fact, under Kuchma, who had been the relatively nationalist leader of Ukraine prior to the Orange Revolution, you had a solid 10% yearly growth with inflation under control. He had proven himself, and that's why it took so much media propaganda, endlessly negative stories run in the Ukrainian press, much of that financed by the U.S., Washington Post and New York Times own a substantial proportion of so much of the media. The major oligarchs in Ukraine controlled the media at the time, did everything in their power to, first of all, cover over the economic success of his administration on the one hand, and then attempt to accuse him of some of the most heinous crimes on the other. But as far as the Orange Revolution is concerned, even their pet media has not been able to cover over these crimes. The debt right now is roughly 16% of the GDP, which is completely outrageous. And according to some estimates within Ukraine itself, 2009, just in January, just in the month of January, you have seen a 20% decline in economic activity. It's very rare to find, you know, outside of the fall of communism, you saw these numbers, but that was about it. You know, outside of total warfare, these numbers are absolutely, positively unbelievable. And, you know, here's the thing. When you have a Western-installed presidency, you know, speaking very generally, you've had this kind of power sharing between Tymoshenko, who made her billions controlling natural gas, and the current president, Viktor Yushchenko, he made his money largely in banking. So you have, you know, two major oligarchical areas of power, basically sharing power. And what happened is, because the economy is falling, the economy is failing by a ridiculous amount, suggesting that the oligarchs are essentially moving their money over, you know, moving their money out of the country, into Swiss banks, to Israel, to the United States. They began printing money. They began printing money, and so you've had no attempt whatsoever to control inflation. This is the reason that their normal political base in West Ukraine, parts of North Ukraine, have now completely abandoned the Orange Revolution and want the government to resign in fairly large numbers. Number one, they feel betrayed, which they certainly are. Number two, they feel manipulated, which they absolutely were. And number three, their standard of living is now below third world standards. So, in terms of basic industry, remember, Ukraine, being a part of the Soviet Union for so long, developed an economy that was largely an appendage of the Soviet Union. Regions specialized in a certain set of areas, and then you had a fully integrated economy if you bring all of these areas together. But now these areas are largely independent, you have a problem. Ukraine, with a very well-educated, literate, very scientifically minded population, Ukraine specialized in electronics, in transportation, and they shared that with the Caucasus region, actually, Armenia and Georgia in particular, and the high-tech sector. The other area that was very heavily invested in by the Soviet government was steel, and all the non-ferrous metals that were so important to the Soviet war machine and to the Soviet economy. Those sectors declined 25% so far this year. So you have one-fifth of the economy going off the books somehow, being, you know, obviously being shipped out of the country or being put into other things that can't easily be traced, as well as in Ukraine's specialized areas, a decline so far this year of 25%. And it's gotten so bad that instead of dealing with the corruption, Tymoshenko is going around the world, traveling the world, trying to raise further loans to buttress her government, to buttress the hryvnia or the Ukrainian currency. This is the outrage of this situation. Even now, going to what Tymoshenko called the archenemy of all Ukrainians, Russia, which, by the way, is not accepted as the case in Ukraine. Ukrainians don't believe Russia is the enemy. I can quote you poll after poll after poll where Ukrainians are generally favorably disposed to Russia and Putin in general. And they're more disposed to Putin than they are to their own government. And I can quote you poll after poll that says that. But for years, the propaganda line was that Russia is our enemy, America is our friend. Now, in desperation, Tymoshenko has had to go with her tail between her, between her legs to go to Russia and beg for a loan. And if nothing else more blatantly shows the failure of the Orange Revolution than that. There is some, there is some positive news, and, we're gonna get to that, and the Party of Regions, the pro-Russian and social nationalist Party of Regions, under the control of Viktor Yanukovych, we will deal with him when we come back.
Don't go away, because there's more on the Orthodox Medievalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Return to the Orthodox Medievalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, we are back. We're dealing with Ukraine in 2009, and it does make a very, very, very depressing picture. The Orange Revolution installed by the United States and the Jewish oligarchs in 2004 has shown itself, as this writer predicted, as many others predicted at the time, to be the most corrupt government in the post-Soviet world, and it is absolutely the case. What we're seeing in Ukraine in late 2008, early 2009, is the complete and utter collapse of consumer confidence and the complete collapse of confidence in the Ukrainian currency. I mentioned before that you've seen a full quarter drop in industrial output, industrial growth, negative growth in this case, in Ukraine. You know, steel, Ukrainian steel, and the entire metal industry accounts for roughly 40% of all Ukrainian exports. And it has fallen, or it's a part of this massive free fall in the economy. When you throw around numbers in terms of economic decline, like 20%, like 25% in the space of a few months, you're dealing with complete collapse. You're not just talking about a recession or a depression or Ukraine being the victim of global financial meltdowns. I mean, the Ukrainian government is a product of the people who are responsible for the financial meltdown in the world. It's far more than that. It is a complete collapse of the economic basis of the state. The International Monetary Fund is demanding further reforms in Ukraine, and frankly, the IMF has no moral right to dictate to Ukraine what they should do, not for the least of reasons that it was the IMF advice that led to the rise of the oligarchs in the first place, and all of these rigged privatization deals that led to a Slavic universe that is controlled to a great extent by a handful of powerful Zionist families. But the IMF is demanding reforms. The Orange government cannot provide those reforms. They cannot provide those reforms for this reason. Because their political base is centralized upon the support of oligarchical rule. The support of oligarchical rule means that, number one, the oligarchy in Western Ukraine has to be placated at all costs. And therefore, since they control much of the economy, no reform can possibly go through and be successful. And number two, it also means that Orange Revolution supporters in all areas of government, in all areas of the economy, have to be given incomes and given jobs, whether or not there's money to pay them. And as I said before, the Orange government just printed money to pay these people off. And as a result of all of this, you have an extremely high inflation rate. You have absolutely no reform in the economy. You have no confidence in parliament, the Rada. You have no confidence in the government, the currency, or in the economy whatsoever. So that means that that handful of Ukrainians who can hold on to a job are certainly not putting their money in banks. What you have is a complete financial and economic meltdown as the oligarchs control almost, you know, the entire wealth of the country, and what they're doing to avoid any further destruction is sending their liquidity off to banks overseas, or at least outside of Ukraine. There have been violent protests all over the country, which to a great extent have been suppressed by the American press. Ukraine used to be, in 2004, 2005, was on the front page of every newspaper, now suddenly is buried because the American-backed Orange Revolution is being blamed, rightfully so, for everything that is wrong with this economy. Ukraine went from a substantial rebound under Leonid Kuchma to an absolute third world standard of living in 2009. Official unemployment, I think, is being put at like 15%, but that's absurd. Every estimate of Ukrainian unemployment now is saying something along the lines of 40%, but much, much higher if you include those people who simply, who work off the books part-time or even quarter-time, who no longer work because they simply see no point in it. Why earn money that's going to be worthless by the end of the year if inflation is, you know, 3, 4, 5% a month and growing, by the way? So if you take all of that into consideration, you're talking about an employment rate of roughly half the working age population. There's violent protests all over Ukraine, and they are blaming the banks, they're blaming the state, and they're blaming the United States. That can only mean one thing. That, number one, the oligarchs are getting very nervous. And number two, that the Ukrainian population, even more than they did a few years ago, is looking for some kind of economic arrangement with Russia, Belarus, and Kazakhstan to create a free trade zone that can help the Slavic economies bounce back, which, of course, is an absolute nightmare for the United States. But since the U.S. is to a great extent being blamed, and there's a lot of righteousness to that claim, the fact is that the reaction to that is increasing victory for the pro-Russian and nationalist Party of Regions, on the one hand, who is, of course, by far the dominant opposition group, now has a majority of the Ukrainian support in the country, and a support for some kind of closer union with Russia and Belarus. Because Belarus is a social nationalist state, it has come under attack from the West. But as the economies of the Slavic world are shrinking, Belarus has grown 10% year on year so far in 2009. The unemployment rate, according to the World Bank, is roughly 1%. But again, because certain sectors of the population often don't get included, it might be 2 or 3%. And something else very interesting. There's a measure out there, a very important measure, called the Gini Index. The Gini Index is a statistical approach to how income is distributed over a population. The point of the Gini Index is that it avoids the problems inherent in a simple, too simple per capita GDP measure. Per capita GDP measure means absolutely nothing. You simply take the whole income of the country and divide it by the number of people. That tells you absolutely nothing. The Gini Index takes not an average, but a median measure. There's a big difference here. Average is measuring income relative to the number of people. The Gini Index is a median measure, which means it takes every person, every household in a country, and lines them up from A to Z, and then picks the one in the middle. That usually, particularly in an oligarchical world, is going to get you a very different result than a mere average. So, the Gini Index, then, is a fairly accurate measure of how income is distributed in a given society. Absolute equality would be zero. Absolute oligarchy, where one person controls all the money, would be 100. That's how the index works. And Belarus, given its social nationalist status, has one of the lower Gini Index results of in the world, and it's 27.9, which strongly suggests a relatively successful policy of income equalization. It's much, much higher. Off the top of my head, I think it's in the 40s, if not higher, in Ukraine. And it's dropping in Russia. So the Gini Index is, in fact, a income equality index, or it's an index that gives us some clue of to what extent the oligarchs control a country. And in Belarus, you have one of the lowest at 27, which is an excellent measure, strongly suggesting that Lukashenko not only is bringing the country through very difficult times with spectacular growth, but is doing this without creating his own oligarchy. I mentioned that according to the World Bank, Ukrainian industry has gone down in terms of production, in terms of its capacity, by a full quarter, by a full 25% in 2009 so far, which are unbelievable numbers. According to the CIA, the industrial growth of Belarus has been almost 12%. And that's a CIA estimate, a CIA that has made it its life's work right now to overthrow the government of Lukashenko in Minsk. But here's a clue as maybe why this is the case and why Belarus is not only surviving this economic struggle, but is actually thriving. I think the only real problem with Belarus right now is inflation is going up, given essentially the overheating of the economy in a hostile environment, to certainly to be expected. I think it's like 12% now, which is really 1% a month is still totally unacceptable. But and then of course the IMF is claiming that Belarus doesn't have substantial gold reserves, and it needs to boost its reserve, which is probably true. But since the United States has absolutely no reserves, I'm not really sure how useful that measure is. But here's one of the real reasons that Lukashenko gets attacked so brutally in the West, called everything. They call him a new Hitler. They call him everything. You know, all the old slogans they dust off every few years for somebody. And Lukashenko is usually under attack. The eyes of the oligarchy are now on Iran, so he's kind of got a little bit of a respite, but the West is outraged and the IMF is outraged because most of the available liquidity, most of the available money that are going to businesses in the form of loans to assist their development and expansion come from four state-controlled banks. Those four banks, controlled by the state, are largely in charge of economic policy. That's the big difference. They're not controlled by bankers. They're controlled by the state. And they could be doing a better job of controlling the value of the currency. But an overheated economy in a hostile environment, I think most would agree that inflation is going to be the result. In other words, it's just being too successful. There is a concern about the reserves in the country. And but there is a as always with Belarus, a positive trade balance. There is a trade surplus, been a trade surplus in Belarus for many, many years now. I think that has a lot to do with a rational economic policy that has Belarusians at its center versus an oligarchic banking clan that controls Ukraine and America and Great Britain that has their own personal wealth and globalization as its primary concern. So, I mean, here, I mean, I can't see what more I can do to convince people of the intelligence of a basic social nationalist approach to economics, where you have Belarus that is growing substantially, and one of the great examples of an oligarchic economy in Ukraine that is now absolutely in an economic freefall, and a freefall that really I can't see any substantial recovery anytime soon. And I think this will create a certain support for a union with Russia and Belarus and a form of government that is closer to what Lukashenko has succeeded in creating in Belarus and what Putin has attempted to create with a substantial amount of success in Russia. I want to talk about the political program of Viktor Yanukovych. Yanukovych really is going, you know, traveling the country, simply repeating really in basic terms what I've been saying. Quoting these statistics, talking about the orange government, talking about how necessary it is for Slavic peoples and Orthodox peoples to unite their economic forces and not be in thrall to the Western banks. Yanukovych's program really starts first and foremost with the raising of minimum wages and wages throughout the country. That when you have a situation where pretty much half the population lives under the poverty line, helping the poorest of citizens is the minimal purpose of the state. That within, particularly now, that the anti-Russian sentiment that the government has attempted to create in the country has been absolutely destructive. He wants increased investment in the Crimea, the Crimean Tartars. The Crimea as a whole was given under the Khrushchev administration to Ukraine. They have never accepted their control by Ukraine and have sought union with Russia, and as a result have strongly supported Yanukovych's Party of Regions, or the main opposition party. Yanukovych says that he knows that there's a lot of natural gas that has not been tapped in the Crimea, and he wants major, this is public investment, in the Crimea in terms of pumping out this gas as a hope of revitalizing the economy. And he's very upset that the European Union have put a tremendous tariff barrier on Ukrainian grain. And what Yanukovych is looking for is an agricultural free trade zone with the Slavic world as well as with the European Union. He believes in local conciliarism, the so-called subbono pravan, which is something that I've always had as the center of my political world. He sees the sobor, or the council, at all levels of government, taking in as many people as possible, central to the economic recovery and growth of the population and of the society as a whole. He wants the Orthodox Church close to society and to be a partner in assisting the poor and assisting in the moral regeneration of the Ukrainian people, and he's made that very clear over the years. And he also, and this is something I've been saying for many years, I have several articles out on this, that domestic agriculture and the revitalization of the Ukrainian village is central to and absolutely integral to economic development, to economic recovery, and to the de-oligarchization of Ukraine. Domestic agriculture is absolutely important. And, of course, stopping this insane printing of money and cutting the government bureaucracy. And I think that a closer union with Moscow and Belarus, which is something that Yanukovych strongly supports, that would include Kazakhstan and Armenia, all of these are rapidly developing social nationalist economies that are doing very, very well, that Ukraine can then relive the economic performance of Leonid Kuchma, where you saw 10-11% growth rates every year and saw some substantial recovery. So to conclude here today, I think I've made it painfully clear the absolute fourth world status now of Ukraine and the reason why they have reached fourth world status. Ukraine is, on a day-to-day basis, one of the poorest countries in the world, where Belarus is becoming one of the best off, at least according to the UN, in terms of quality of life. So there you have a blatant contrast concerning economic policy and the role of the state and the role of government and what true social nationalism can do. And here you have a contrast that really should get people thinking. So I want to thank everybody for listening. I want to thank Steve and Mishko and Dietrich and Mike and everybody at the Voice of Reason for helping me out here. It's been a pleasure, and I thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Medievalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
You're tuned in to